Hello and welcome to the Science Bloggers Podcast. I'm your host, David Latchman, and my guest today is Rob Lee. Rob is a science writer and journalist with a background in physics. In this episode, we are talking about quantum mysticism in physics. We discuss why the belief exists and its possible connections to other anti-science views and what it means for us as science communicators. So, hello Rob, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, David, and thank you for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. So, before we start, why don't you tell the listeners a little something about yourself and what you do?
So, I'm a freelance science writer based in the UK. I'm currently in the last year of my degree with the Open University. I also study journalism. And I've been writing about science, mainly physics, for about roughly 8 years. I came into it through quite a different route than a lot of science writers, in that I originally began writing about skepticism and debunking things like alternative medicine and tabloid news stories about the supernatural and paranormal and all that kind of nonsense, and eventually came into science writing via that way, which is quite an unusual route, I think, to get into science writing, but there you go, that's how it happened for me. So,
well, we all have our story, and not everyone comes in through the traditional journalism route.
Mm.
You had a special topic that you wanted to talk about today, mysticism in quantum mechanics.
That's right, yeah. So essentially what I find, and I know you yourself, you've studied physics, David, and I'm sure you find this a lot. When there's any kind of discussion about quantum mechanics or quantum physics in popular media, what you tend to find is it focuses on this kind of mysticism aspect of it. So you have people like Deepak Chopra and Robert Lanza exploiting the mystery around quantum physics. You know, I'm sure your audience is familiar with the fallacy God of the Gaps. I find that a lot of the gaps have retreated to quantum physics because there are still a lot of unknowns in that area of physics. I find a lot of it has kind of retreated to there, and that's where the mysticism kind of lies. And, you know, say you, when you Google an aspect of quantum mechanics, like, say, entanglement, what you'll generally come back with is more information about, you know, mystical elements and the idea that consciousness causes wave function collapse. And it's difficult for the layman to then sift through that and actually get accurate information about quantum mechanics that's underlying that. And I think that's unfortunate, because it really is a wonderful field and it's given us so much and it has so much utility that it's quite scary that general audiences would find it so difficult to access accurate information about that.
I agree with you. I mean, also as fellow physicist, that, you know, quantum mechanics is fascinating. So why do you think so many people resort to this mystical explanation for it?
Part of the problem lies with ourselves as physicists and physicists that have gone before us, because everybody who has a particular discipline or subject wants to engage and entertain an interested audience. And obviously, to get anybody to take your subject seriously and to start listening, you initially have to engage them. And I think physicists, we tend to focus on the mysteries of quantum physics and quantum mechanics a little bit too much. I think we've laid it on to fit the idea of we don't really know what's happening. When you see quantum mechanics reported about in the popular media, the press in general, what you'll generally find is there's, you know, a number of quotes from various, you know, historical scientific figures like Einstein. If you've got a new story on entanglement, you'll find Einstein's quote about spooky action at a distance will always top that article. If it's a popular article, that quote will always be there somewhere in the opening few paragraphs. It might even be headed, you know, spooky action. Now, when we consider that quote, what we should be considering is, obviously Einstein was a genius, but he was also a man of his time. And that quote's almost 100 years old. And I don't think Einstein would have, in hindsight, made that quote had he have realized that by this point in our development of science and our development of quantum mechanics, we'd be using things like entanglement as regularly as we do. You know, if you want to order a bicycle pump off the internet, somewhere along that process, you're probably using entanglement, you know, to connect to your bank or to connect to the website that you're using. There's probably, you know, some element of entanglement there with a, you know, quantum cryptography going on, which is, you know, the exchange of entangled keys. So that's, you know, one way we prevent hacking and fraud when we contact our banks. So I don't think in hindsight, Einstein perhaps would have issued that quote if he were to know, but obviously he was a man of his time and couldn't have possibly known the development with quantum mechanics over the next 100 years.
I agree that the language that they used then is somewhat problematic.
Mm.
So the other example that we can look at is, say, the double-slit experiment. And, you know, one experiment where they try to determine, you know, which photon or which electron goes through the double-slit experiment destroys that interference pattern.
Yeah.
You know, one of the explanations is that observing the particle destroys that interference pattern. And I think, you know, that choice of word, observation, is problematic because, you know, you have to look at a deeper philosophical question of what an observation is, right?
Well, essentially, by the use of that word, what early quantum physicists did, and they couldn't have possibly known they were about to do this, but what they did was they actually opened the door to a lot of quantum mysticism. Because the idea of an observation immediately conjures images of a conscious observer. Yeah, absolutely. When really what we're talking about is a measurement. If you said measurement rather than observation, then what you're doing is it's far colder term that doesn't imply as much a conscious observer. Obviously, eventually there has to be some form of conscious observer, you know, taking a note of that measurement, but it doesn't make it as immediate. And I think the use of that word observe, as you highlighted, is essentially where a lot of the problems with quantum mysticism begin. And we're still guilty of it today. When you see a diagram of the double slit experiment and we want to represent measurement of the photons, you know, a kind of which way information being collected, which is when we place a detector at the double slit. Most diagrams use an eyeball to represent some kind of detection going on there, which again gives the impression that there's some kind of human observer looking at it, which when you actually consider that and consider we're talking normally about things like electrons and single photons, the idea of somebody peering in on that experiment, watching which way the electron goes, it's absurd, really, isn't it? Because you could never hope to see an electron or a single photon. You know, it's ludicrous, really, isn't it? But there you go, that's the situation that we have.
Well, yeah, yes, it is. But, you know, in a way, you know, I can also defend physicists for those choice of words. You know, when I was an undergraduate, sometimes we'd have these lunchtime symposiums. And if you got there early, right, the professor who was giving that symposium would have these little, you know, philosophical discussions on physics. And, you know, one of them was that, you know, the very act of measurement changes anything, which you know. So if you were measuring the resistance of a resistor, you put your ohmmeter in parallel across the resistor. Mm. But to get a reading that's close to the actual resistor you need, your ohmmeter needs to be of infinite resistance.
Yeah,
that's impossible.
Yeah.
So you need a high enough resistor in for your ohmmeter to get as close enough. That'll give you a measurement that's as close enough to the actual resistor that you're measuring. And that's just one example.
Yeah, absolutely. You can never really totally remove the experimenter effect, because any kind of system that you interfere with, there's been interference to make a measurement, hasn't there? So,
you know, there's no situation you can think of where you're doing an experiment where your interaction of measuring it isn't going to change. And, you know, it's like, for example, if you decide to measure a pendulum, right? And you create this device, you use a laser, and you set up a counter. And you might think, well, that's one way in which you do it. But, you know, when you think about it, it's like, well, laser beam has photons, right? And it's going to strike the pendulum. And it's going to impart a small force, which is
momentum,
going to affect the frequency of vibration. It becomes a forced pendulum.
Yeah.
It's going to be small, but, you know, it's going to change it subtly. And I think the general public, one, they don't have that kind of discussion.
Yeah.
So for us, when we say observer and measurement, it's one and the same, right? But I don't think the public necessarily knows what that philosophical difference is, that distinction.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Are we to blame for that? Yes and no. I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. I don't think necessarily that you could actively blame anybody. I don't think you could say, well, I just think that it was kind of an error in presentation, in a way that, which obviously, you know, if you look at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, you can't really, this is an entirely new science, and no one would think that the choice of just one word would change how it was going to be interpreted by the public so far down the line. I don't think anybody could have really had foresight as regards to that when that word was chosen. I just think it's unfortunate that the word, when we chose the word observe and observer, that was pounced upon in a way by these people who want to, you know, sell quantum mysticism and quantum woo. Because the thing about that is, there's no doubt about it, it's a boom industry. I mean, you and I have really come into the wrong end of physics. If we wanted to make a little bit of money, we should be selling books like Deepak Chopra, you know.
I know. Yeah.
That's where the money is in physics. And not necessarily, not to speak ill of him, but, you know, I think the studying's a bit less intensive too. So,
yes, it is. You know, quantum mechanics is difficult to comprehend at times, even when you're a physicist who has studied it. But, you know, they come up with this, like, really fantastic explanation that makes it seem so easy, even though it's completely wrong.
Yeah, it's really an exercise in baffling the audience. If you throw in enough jargon, because that's the one thing you can't ever criticize Deepak Chopra for, certainly, is this man knows his jargon. And if you throw enough jargon to an audience that's perhaps not as savvy with those things, which, you know, is no criticism of the audience, you are going to confound them and confuse them so much that they think you know what you were talking about. A good example for me, I don't know if you've heard of Robert Lanza and his book Biocentrism. Now, Robert Lanza, he's the person currently pushing the quantum consciousness connection. So the idea that when a particle is passing through the double slit experiment and the wave function collapses, it's conscious observation that's causing that wave function collapse. Now, in Robert Lanza's book, I actually bought it because I was having constant online arguments with people who have obviously never studied quantum mechanics more than reading the work of someone like Robert Lanza or Deepak Chopra. So I actually bought the book. And what I found when I went through it was the man simply doesn't understand mathematics well enough to grasp quantum mechanics. Now, the problem with him is he's a very eminent, well-respected, and well-decorated scientist, but not in the field of physics. He's a biologist. He's a geneticist. He's done some sterling work in those areas. But then he kind of sneaks through the door of, well, he's got all these accreditations, but none of them are in the area of physics. And I found some really fundamental math errors in his work and thought, well, you can't possibly understand quantum mechanics if you don't understand that the square, for an example, this is just an example taken from his book, that the square root of one is one. If he doesn't understand that, then I'm sorry, I don't think he's grasped the mathematics of quantum mechanics well enough to be writing thousands of pages about it.
Well, you're right. You know, a lot of people who peddle this type of quantum mechanics where it's connected to biology and consciousness, they don't understand quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, there are some physicists out there who supposedly do and are peddling, you know, some really terrible physics.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know of this physicist named Dr. Quantum. I believe his real name is Dr. Wolf. Dr. Fred Wolf.
Is he the guy with the YouTube channel and it's like a cartoon?
Yeah.
Is that God. Yeah, it's terrible.
I think he was in this movie, What the Bleep Do We Know?
What the Bleep Do We Know? Right. Yeah, that's right.
And it starred Molly Matlin. And, you know, it was so unfortunate because I like her. You know, I think she's a great actor. And she does this movie. And I'm like, oh my God, why did you do this?
I've not actually watched the whole film, but I've seen clips of it. And I've seen the Dr. Quantum clip in particular, because anytime I write something about the double slit experiment, guaranteed in the comment section, someone will direct me towards that Dr. Quantum clip. And I absolutely hate it. I've always meant to do, because I do have my own YouTube channel, but I don't, it's making YouTube videos, and it's something you have to put a lot of time and effort into. And I'm very busy, and B, I'm intrinsically lazy, so I really don't have the time to do that. But if I was going to start again, I think a debunking of that terrible Dr. Quantum video in particular about the double slit experiment, it'd be the first thing I did. Because again, all of that misunderstanding and all of that mispresentation in that video begins with that word observe and the idea that there must be a conscious observer. That's where it all stems, and it's kind of spreads out from there. It's like a little tiny crack that just gets wider and wider and wider until you've shattered your window, to use an analogy.
Yeah, to give the guy some credit, to give Dr. Wolf, you know, credit, is he's an effective communicator.
Oh, yeah, well, that there's no doubt about that. It's just unfortunate why he's chosen to communicate.
Yeah, the fact that people today are still watching that video and using it to understand quantum mechanics speaks to his reach. And I honestly wish that I had that kind of reach.
That's right.
It's crazy.
The difficulty with combating these ideas as well, though, is you immediately start as a naysayer. So if I wanted to critique that particular section of What the Bleep Do We Know, and it's been watched now, must be millions of times on YouTube easily, I'd immediately have to be the naysayer. So I'd immediately be the one on the attack and the critic, which paints me straight away in a negative light and someone who's trying to upset the apple cart. And I think what's quite interesting in the current culture that we've got is if I produced a response video to that, what you'd have is people measuring the views that that video had received against the views that my criticism of it had received. And obviously, it wouldn't be a fair, that's not a fair metric of accuracy, is how many people have engaged with either piece. But that would definitely, because obviously, you know, we've got now an information community that's based on selecting information that's had the most footfall to it. So if you Google double slit experiment on YouTube, for example, if you search on YouTube double slit experiment, that's probably one of the first videos you're going to get. And you're probably going to get a lot of inaccurate videos that follow that video's lead before you come to any kind of informed critique of that. Or any kind of informed video about the double slit experiment.
Yeah, I think you're right. As science communicators, we have a lot to do. There's a lot that we're against in fighting this misinformation. Mm. You know, it's really difficult, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you can definitely, if I wasn't bald already, I think my years as a science communicator would have probably left me in that state, or extremely grey, because you tend to find, I'm sure you find this as well, when you write about particular subjects, you tend to have the same objections and complaints raised every time you broach that subject. So, you know, every time I write about black holes, I'll have the same people pointing out, well, you know, this guy on YouTube says that black holes don't exist. I think his name's something like The Sky Watcher or something like this. And he has a very popular YouTube channel. And he's, you know, he's got qualifications, not necessarily in physics, but he's a doctor or a professor. And he doesn't believe black holes exist. He doesn't believe the current astronomical models about the sun and stars. And it's very difficult to explain to an audience, well, this is a man who presents his work on YouTube, and that's not where science, that's not where orthodox science happens. And I think sometimes when you start saying that, you run the risk of sounding a bit snobbish, that you're discounting all these popular avenues and popular routes to science knowledge. Well, that's really not what you're saying. It's just that there's a reason that he's sneaking those ideas out onto YouTube and not in peer-reviewed literature. There's a reason Bob Lanza, you know, publishes all of his work in biology and genetics through the peer-reviewed literature system, but all of his work in quantum mechanics, he publishes in the popular press and in paperback books. There's a reason for that disparity there, and it's because one element of his work is sound, and the other element he knows is not sound, and he's passing directly to the public because he knows it won't pass peer review. So that's the difficulty, that you have to get people on the same page and say, well, okay, that this isn't where science is done.
Well, I think that's also one of the problems with it, is that people have no idea of how science is done.
Mm.
So you tell them about the peer review process and that, you know, we go through this process of doing this experiment. It has to be reviewed by, you know, dozens of other scientists who are going to like point out your mistakes. They're going to try to replicate, you know, your findings. And then eventually, if you've done a good job, then you may have something there, or you may not.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that's how science is done. I think they like the idea of this lone individual who can topple the system, you know, this David versus Goliath. And, you know, when you look at how we communicate, you know, the history of science,
we sort of do, you know, tell it in that way, right?
That's right.
You look at Einstein, he's working, you know, alone in the Patent Office. Mm. You know, he's scribbling notes on a piece of paper, and he upends, you know, hundreds of years of classical theory.
That's the interesting thing, though. Even though Einstein came from left field with certainly the theory of special relativity, he was still on the field. He wasn't in the bleachers. You know, he might have come from left field, but he was still part of, you know, he'd studied physics. He hadn't got on particularly well with his professors. I know reading a lot of Einstein's letters, he held one of his professors in particular responsible for the fact he couldn't get a teaching position anywhere. He believed that professor was, you know, essentially bad-mouthing him to the science community, which may or may not be true. I wouldn't know. But that's certainly what Einstein believed for a long time and held him responsible for him not being in academia. So even though Einstein came from left field, he still had that background in physics. And not everyone can be an Einstein. Not everyone can hold some idea that shifts the paradigm of science and be correct. Or there wouldn't be paradigms. And I think when people compare themselves, when they've got some crazy harebrained theory and they compare themselves to Einstein, you do want to say, well, actually, you need to consider the millions of other people who had a theory, came from left field, and were completely wrong.
Yeah, and I think you're right. If you want to use that sports analogy, is that it's not like Einstein just walked into the stadium. You know, he's just an average guy, you know, and he walked into the stadium and he changed things.
Picked up a bat and then just whacked the ball out of the stadium, you know.
I mean, he was a player. He had a uniform. He was probably sitting on the bench, but you know, he was part of the team.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
It's not like he was just like the average guy that just came onto the field, you know, and
wowed the crowd. Yeah,
and that's what I don't think many people realize. He's a trained physicist.
Yeah,
and some of these guys that people listen to, a lot of them is like, well, yeah, I don't have an education in science, but I'm going to change things because I spin magnets around. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And when you look at this guy, who doesn't believe in all the astronomical theories about the sun and stars, he is so adamant, and he has a little group of very ardent followers who believe what he's spinning. But when you put him up against the entirety of astronomy and cosmology, to believe that he's going to get this model, his own model of how the sun works, you know, and he's going to be correct and everybody else is not just wrong, but so wrong. Because the thing about relativity is, and also quantum mechanics, that is also one of the major misunderstandings of both fields, is special relativity didn't prove Newton wrong. It proved Newton imprecise. When you work with either quantum mechanics or special relativity, you can recover the equations of Newton, especially when you start to approach everyday masses. You find that the equations that we use in quantum physics, it's called the correspondence principle. You find that you start to recover Newton's equations. And it's the same with special relativity. When you consider low masses, what we call the Lorentz factor starts to move towards one. And it's the Lorentz factor that distinguishes between the equations of special relativity and the equations of Newtonian mechanics. And when that starts to move to one, you start to recover Newtonian mechanics. So it's not like Einstein overturned everything with regards to Newtonian mechanics. He just refined it for a different situation. And I think people fail to understand that sometimes. A lot of people I speak to about it believe that things like general relativity kind of smashed Newtonian mechanics to pieces, but that's actually not true. Newtonian mechanics still works. It only works in a very particular set of circumstances, and maybe it's not as precise as other fields of physics now, or other, is fields, do you think fields is right there? Whatever.
No, it's still applicable in certain branches, I think if you're an engineer, you're going to be pretty happy with Newtonian physics.
That's right,
We don't need to use special relativity or general relativity to measure the length of a bridge or what happens if you crash a car into it, will it survive?
Yeah.
Those things work. I think the way we tell the history of it and, what it all means philosophically, it's a little bit off, both in our physics textbooks and how we tell it to the public.
Yeah.
Because special relativity is a really fantastic, theory in the way that Einstein merges classical mechanics with, electromagnetic theory. And that's really what he did. And he reconciled how those two can come together into a consistent form.
Mm.
And when you think about it philosophically, that's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
but
I mean, and the way Einstein arrived at it, just from essentially looking at the equations of Maxwell as well, and envisioning that there was something that these equations were telling him, almost like he had an instinctive idea that there's something those equations are telling him about the nature of light, which was essentially what he arrived at first was the consistency of the speed of light, the fact that that's, it's a set parameter that it always travels at the same speed in a vacuum. And not just that, but for every observer in every inertial frame, it always travels at C. Quite a remarkable undertaking and finding, but I think that physicists may have arrived at that themselves. I think if Einstein hadn't have come along, I think we would have arrived at special relativity. I'm not sure we would have got to general relativity though.
I think you're right. Special relativity, at least, I'm not a historian. I've just done a little research on it, and I think all the ingredients for special relativity were there, right?
Yeah.
So that equation that gamma that comes up frequently in special relativity, we already had that before Einstein wrote any papers, right? So I think, we would have come up with it. And, Einstein was working in the patent office, and at that time, there's this huge problem in maintaining or keeping time between various cities as they travel. How do you synchronize time from one city to the other? And there were a lot of patents that were coming out. So that's part of how Einstein came up with some of these thought experiments that he did.
Yeah.
And I think someone would have come up with it. It may not have been in the same way that Einstein thought of it, but I think someone would have done it. So who knows? And, this comes back to what we were saying earlier is where we believe that, we have this one special person who's going to topple everything down.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. If Einstein wasn't born, someone else would have done it.
Yeah. That's especially true for quantum mechanics, isn't it? Because when you look at the amount of people who were initially involved in the foundation of quantum mechanics, and especially the way it passed from hand to hand, because the wonderful thing about quantum mechanics is there's no one particular figure that you could say was associated with it. I'd say Erwin Schrödinger early on in the idea of describing a moving particle as a wave would be an important one. But then you kind of leave Erwin Schrödinger behind, because then the more he explored quantum mechanics, the more he was a big proponent, like Einstein, that there must be hidden variables with entanglement. So what he and Einstein believed, that quantum mechanics was an incomplete theory. There must be these hidden variables that inform two entangled particles of, you know, what values they have, you know, at the moment they're produced rather than the moment they're measured. Careful not to use the word observed. And it's kind of the way, interesting the way, if you look at the history of quantum mechanics, it's kind of handed off at various points. People come to a limit of it, and this is as far as they're prepared to go. You know, famously, Einstein, who challenged our ideas about the very nature of time and space, which, again, we both believe that special relativity would have been arrived at by another physicist eventually. But I'm not entirely sure that that other physicist would have had the nerve to challenge the very ideas of space, and the idea that a traveling object contracts, or that you know, time changes based on the proximity to a gravitational source, because time was considered immutable. And the idea that Einstein, who challenged these very ideas, just couldn't deal with the idea that quantum mechanics was complete, and therefore there's an underlying indeterminacy and probabilistic nature to physics, and that's as far as he could go. And I think it's interesting that quantum physics destroys this one person narrative a little bit, that I think we've inherited from our nature as storytelling creatures. We have a hero of the story, and you can't do that with the history of quantum mechanics. It kind of gets passed along like a hot potato a little bit.
I guess one question, you know, that I can ask you as a science communicator is, how do we combat this misinformation, you know, this bad narrative that we have inherited over time? How do we correct that?
I think it's difficult, because I do think that a lot of it goes to our very nature, which I think, as you know, as I mentioned there, as storytelling animals, will always be driven to narratives that we agree with or that give us comfort. I think the reason quantum mysticism is quite popular is, I think it's seized upon by quite intelligent people who want to believe there is still an element of the supernatural to the physical world. And the idea, what I find is, through my actions in skepticism, I've dealt with a lot of different people who believe different things. And I tend to find that people who believe in psi and the quantum consciousness connection are better read, better self-educated, and more passionate than believers in any other wild and wacky theory. And that's difficult. That's always going to be a tough nut to crack, because they are well informed, but they're very good at finding the information that ultimately supports their idea that life continues after death. One way I've tried to combat it is, I actually believe that the double slit experiment directly contradicts the idea of consciousness surviving outside of the body and mind-body duality. I think the double slit experiment, rather than proving that consciousness can exist away from physical material, I think it very adequately proves that it can't. And ultimately, the reason for that, and this is how I try and dispel these ideas by using that same experiment, ultimately the reason for that is because we understand it so well. It's probably the most performed experiment in the history of science, or in the history of physics, certainly over the last 100 years. And what you look at is, you always obtain the same results. So when you're firing your electrons through your double slit, if you don't attempt to measure it at the slit. If you don't try and get which way information, you will always get the wave pattern. And if you do try and get that which way information, you always get this particle behavior. That so the interference is always destroyed. You always destroy that wave pattern. Now, if consciousness could exist separate from the body, what you'd have is these free-floating consciousnesses that would occasionally interfere with that experiment. They'd occasionally cause the wave function to collapse. And what that would look like to us in the laboratory would be that the wave function was collapsing for no apparent reason. So I think the fact that we keep that wave function behavior until we try and measure it, and it's always that interference that collapses it, shows that consciousness either can't collapse the wave function or doesn't exist aside from matter, away from matter. So I think that when they use the double slit experiment as kind of proof that consciousness can have its own existence, when they attempt to use that, what they're actually doing is they're using a piece of evidence that doesn't support them at all. It actually does the opposite. And I think that's one way of combating those ideas, is turning them on their head and getting people to look at it a different way.
Well, one, they have to want to look at it a different way rather than cling
to what they
believe. You know, I mean, you know, I sort of get it, you know, giving up this belief that consciousness is somehow separate from the physical structure of your brain.
Mm.
It's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I kind of like your idea of it. It sounds like something that we can use in like one of those ghost hunter reality shows, right? So...
Oh, God, you're wasting your time with those people.
You know, you can just, like, set up the double slit experiment, and you're just like, okay, if they're a ghost here, they will observe the experiment, and they'll destroy the...
And they'll collapse the wave function. Yeah, absolutely. And what you will find is those ghost hunting television shows, you'll hear quantum physics mentioned far more than you might expect.
Oh,
By those programs. And
I have actually never watched a ghost hunting show.
Okay. Well, I it's not something I'm going to advise you to get started on doing. So I'm not going to lead you down that rabbit hole, because that's something that I found myself asked to do for a podcast a long time ago, and I ended up watching far more than I would have liked. But what you'll find is you will hear them talk about quantum physics quite a lot, and they'll always go back to the double slit experiment. They'll always go back to the idea that consciousness changes reality, because that's how they see it, is that you've changed. Because that's one of my frustrations. I'm sure you have that as well. Sorry to go off on a tangent, but when you read a popular presentation of quantum mechanics, and it will say, it'll describe particle wave duality as light is both a wave and a particle. No, that's wrong. Light is light. Sometimes it acts like a wave. Sometimes it acts like a particle. It isn't a wave or a particle. Light's light. And the same with particle wave duality all across the board, is not light is this, a particle is this. It's acting like that at that time. Even with the wave-like behavior of things like electrons, what you could say is, well, no, because we don't actually know that the wave function is an actual thing. It's just a mathematical model of how that particle is behaving at that time. We don't know that it's really like a wave, because we can't measure it, and we can't measure it without changing it. So in a way, it could never be like a wave. It could always be acting like a particle. We just model it like a wave, because the wave equations that we've got in mathematics happen to be a good description of that behavior.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, it's getting that message across is still so difficult.
And you're fighting against the tide, aren't you? there's so many different sources of misinformation that even if there were, even if everybody, but I don't know what your thoughts are on this, David, but I sometimes feel that people who have studied physics and people who are qualified in physics don't tend to look back and deal with these problems as much as maybe they should. I think we tend to collect our qualification and then move forward and focus on the more serious research. And I think that's the problem with science across the board. And that's why I'm so happy to be part of a community of science communicators who are really attempting to combat this. Is I think science has left the general public behind a lot. And I think that's why you get a bit of animosity towards science and scientists. That certainly, without wanting to get too political, you can see at the moment in politics, in, you know, UK politics and American politics, that there's this distrust of experts. There's this distrust of mathematicians and scientists and economists. And I think a lot of that in science is because we've kind of left the general public behind. And if we don't come back and dispel these ideas of mysticism, of elements like this, if we don't come back and do that, then the canyon between the general public and the science community is just going to get wider. It's going to become more of a problem. I think it was Carl Sagan who pointed out before his death what dangerous times we live in when we're so dependent on science, but so few of us actually understand it.
And, you know, I agree that scientists and science communicators and science journalists, we all need to do a much better job.
Mm.
You know, I think, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, scientists are doing a lot more work today than they have been in the past, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot more collaborative. So they're working with each other. They're working on much more difficult problems.
Mm.
They need a much wider skill set today. So you're not just a physicist, you know, you're working with people in chemistry and, you know, who's doing computational modeling, and, you know, it's really fantastic. But, you know, they have a lot of work to do as a scientist. You know, you have to do research, you have to get grant money. So there's a lot on their plate.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think that there's also a problem with how we communicate. And one, you know, I think within the past 20 or 20 something years, you know, we have been using something called the deficit model of science communication. And basically what that says, it's that people don't know because they lack information. And if we just gave them this information, they would come to that understanding.
Yeah.
And they'll become enlightened.
Mm.
And I think we all have that experience of that is completely wrong.
Yeah, I don't necessarily believe that's true. Some people don't want the information. They want to believe what they already believe. So what they're doing is they're looking for science that confirms the beliefs that they are already hold.
Exactly. And you know, I think that illustrates why the deficit model is wrong, because it gives human beings this rather simplistic method of acquiring information.
Yeah.
You know, we don't look at the complexities of human thought. Right.
Mm.
So if you want to go back to this whole observer thing in physics, you know, people are stuck on, you know, the concept of mortality.
Yeah.
You know, what happens when all of that is tied up with what you're trying to communicate. And these are some of the things we have to address. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also look at it in terms of climate change or GMOs. Right.
Yeah.
If you tell people, well, we have to address climate change, and if you're a coal miner and you're saying, well, coal is you know, spewing all this carbon into the atmosphere, and now you're saying, like, well, I'm a coal miner, are you saying, like, I'm the bad guy here? Am I responsible for this?
Mm.
So, you know, we definitely have to change the way we communicate. We need to be more interactive. We need to listen. People need to have a sense that they are part of that discussion as well.
Yeah.
Rather than just, hey, I'm telling you.
Being lectured to. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I think that's what you know, being a science communicator, being a blogger or YouTuber or podcaster, I think that can help in some way because you are directly communicating with people. You're interacting with them.
Yeah. And of course, these new methods of communicating ideas as well. You know, so what I wouldn't want is it comes across as when I say there's so much misinformation about certain elements of physics on YouTube. What I wouldn't do is immediately throw the baby out of the bathwater and say, well, okay, that means that YouTube is a terrible way of getting ideas across.
No.
Because obviously you're conceding ground there to the people who would sow misinformation. What you have to do is find, as communicators, we have to find the best way of manipulating these platforms and using these platforms to get across good ideas rather than bad ideas.
That's right. I think, it's important as science communicators that we learn and understand these platforms to the best of our ability to get that message across,
Yeah.
Whether it's blogging or being on YouTube or podcasting or whatever technology is going to bring us, we have to adapt and change.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely true. And at least there are those technologies to take advantage of now. So as much... maybe if you flood the what's called the marketplace of ideas with good ideas, hopefully eventually you'll get to the point where the bad ideas are maybe they'll always be there, but maybe they're less. Maybe they're mixed with a better or a better amount of content that's more correct or more accurate, or at least leads down the right path rather than leading down the rabbit hole of bad information.
Yeah, hopefully, that's a goal. Hopefully people get more good information and accept that than bad information, because our survival depends on it right now.
That's the crazy thing about science communication at the moment. It is, if we don't start changing people's minds about certain ideas very quickly, then we're actually looking at, disaster in a multitude of different ways, not just with climate change, but with things like antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. We're looking, if people don't start using antibiotics in a different way, and in a more limited way, then we're looking at a whole strain of
superbugs that will kill us.
Of superbugs that can't be combated, that spell disaster really, really for us. In a way, I almost worry about that more than I worry about climate change at the moment, because I think there's less being done to combat that. But maybe that's not. Maybe we just hear less about it. But I think that's a looming problem that we're going to have to deal with very, very, very shortly.
Well, if that doesn't kill us, the lack of vaccines might do it.
Yeah, that's it. You're painting a very grim picture at the moment, David.
I know.
Because it's like... the case with vaccines is that's an area where that's really depressing, but that's an area where we actually turn the corner and we've been dragged back around.
I know. So. It's like we solved this problem. Why are we here again?
Yeah, so that does make it all a bit, it does put things into perspective that even when we've solved these problems, it doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that the fight's necessarily over, does it? It's the one I'm looking at on the horizon that I think is going to be a fairly big issue is the idea of lab-grown meat and getting people to accept lab-grown meat.
Yeah.
Because I think people are going to have that knee-jerk reaction to it that they've had to GMOs, where they don't necessarily trust it. And, obviously the idea of GMOs is, this could potentially save the planet. It's tied into, to what we're facing ecologically and with lab-grown meat as well. Obviously, if we reduce the amount of cattle that we're keeping, this is going to help. Because I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, is it the biggest source of carbon in the atmosphere comes from, oh, no, it's methane, isn't it?
Yeah, methane is the biggest source, yeah.
So it would be one of the biggest sources of carbon, wouldn't it? Yeah. So, and a lot of that comes from cattle farming. So obviously, if we could find economical lab-grown meat, we could possibly reduce that. But it's getting people to accept that and not having this. Because I think our popular culture has hurt a little bit there, because when you get people who refer to, you know, GMOs as Frankenfoods or Frankenstein foods, and it goes to this idea that in popular culture, we've looked at the mad scientist has become too familiar a trope.
Yes.
You know, the scientist who's tampering with the very elements of nature and how dangerous this is. You'll know from your blog that you write about movie science, you know, how often is the hubris of man tampering with nature? How often is that a movie villain? You know, how often has that caused the problem? And it's very much ingrained in our mindset now that what scientists are doing is tampering with nature, and it's somehow wrong. But I suppose it goes to the natural fallacy as well, the idea that things that are natural are good and things that aren't natural, you know, are somehow wrong, or we shouldn't be doing things that aren't, that we don't find in nature.
Well, you know, that is also the problem, you know, and the idea of what natural is, mm-hmm. different from what, say, you might think it is or what I might think it is,
yeah.
compared yeah. to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we also have to acknowledge that the way this misinformation gets spread, it doesn't just affect us. You know, I think living in a developed nation, you're pretty isolated from some of it, right?
Yeah.
So we cannot use GMOs and we would be fine. But yeah. in developing nations, it's going to be a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
You know, it's going to come down to how they can, you know, provide for themselves or ensure food security, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, if you look at the way, we held back golden rice.
I know, that is like, my God.
Yeah, and it's just purely through ignorance. And you have groups like, you know, Greenpeace who, you know, I'm not necessarily totally against Greenpeace all the time, but you see them wading into cornfields, destroying, you know, golden rice that could potentially save somebody's life, save a child's eyesight there, and you're destroying it in hazmat suits. You know, it's absolutely crazy. And sometimes I feel like it's the Luddite movement all over again. We just haven't. Why haven't we learned? Why have we not developed? Why are we still doing this? Why is there still this distrust of modern technology? And
I know, and you know, again, it's complex because, you know, I'm still preparing for an episode for the podcast where we're going to talk about, you know, GMOs in Nigeria, and I think you may have seen
mm-hmm.
the post in the group. And to fill people in, it's I'm talking to one of the science journalists from Nigeria in the group.
Oh, brilliant.
And he reports on cowpea. You may know it as black-eyed peas.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they're doing this modification so it isn't attacked by pests.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the problems is that a lot of environmentalists are like, oh, you're tampering with food. It's no longer natural.
Uh-huh.
And religion also comes into it. It's like you're tampering with what God provided
yeah.
to us.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Which, I mean, you know, there's a few interesting counters to that naturalistic fallacy of, well, scorpion venom's very natural, but
it will kill you.
You know, it's not so good. You know, also, you know, whenever I hear or see somebody saying, well, I don't agree with this because it's not natural, I often point out, so if you had heart issues, would you have open heart surgery? Because it's not something that we find in nature. you don't tend to find that amongst other mammals that we have open heart surgery. We've, for whatever reason, we've moved past what was maybe natural for our kind of species to do, and we're past that now. And I don't think we should be worrying about the naturalistic fallacy so much when we do so much. You know, driving to work, that's not natural. It's not a natural thing that you'd ever find in nature. You know, hot drinks, you wouldn't find those in nature, really. It's just, it's crazy. So much of our everyday life depends on doing things that aren't natural, but they're not seen as negative. But the second you try and, you know, change a crop in a useful and potentially life-saving way, well, this isn't natural. This isn't natural to do this. And obviously, you've kind of indicated towards there, it's often used to argue against the things as human beings that we find squeamish. So, you know, if you don't approve of the way someone's conducting their life, well, you'll say that this isn't natural or a natural way to behave, you know. So, but if it's not natural to have a mobile phone, I don't see you, you know, I don't see you giving that up anytime soon, but you expect other people to tailor their lifestyle towards what you believe is natural or not, you know. So, but that's a whole different topic, isn't it? Something completely different.
I know. Well, sans communication isn't easy. I mean, if it was, you know, we wouldn't have a community trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have all figured it out and, you know, taken care of these problems long ago. We'd have been in the pub drinking beers by now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what's interesting is, I think science communication is actually a whole different field of science. It's a science in of itself, in a way. So I know when I first embarked on my studying, it was mainly focused on physics, but I found more and more that my interests are actually in science communication, so much more, so much so that I'm hoping to start a master's in the summer. I always imagined myself doing a master's in physics, but now I'm looking at possibly doing a master's in science communication, because in a way, without sounding too altruistic, when it's not necessarily all altruism, it's probably the area in which I can best help at the moment.
Well, you know, I hope it works out and you finish it and you do it.
Isn't that the biggest obstacle, though? Just finishing it would be.
Well, yeah, I think.
I find that with everything, though. Just finishing something I start would be remarkable. How is just finishing something a goal? You know, it's just start something and actually get it finished. Would be really welcome at the moment.
Well, just aim for it, and hopefully you'll get there. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know what else to say.
No, I'm not looking for affirmation. Don't worry, let's not turn this into a counselling session.
You'll try not to.
No, I won't burst into tears. Don't worry.
But it sounds like, you know, we've got like a lot of work to do, our work to cut out for us. Not just in,
well, definitely, yeah.
You know, the,
yeah,
the mysticism of quantum mechanics, but everything else in general.
Yeah. So, I find it's quite interesting that obviously, I don't know how you find these discussions normally go, but a lot of things are, you can find yourself starting at a certain point, and then because things are so intrinsically tied together, and a lot of the issues with, like, what we started talking about, you know, quantum mysticism, a lot of the reason those things occur and persist are the same reasons we resist golden rice, and the same reasons we're having such difficulty, you know, keeping vaccines, you know, administered to people, and the same reason we have so many issues with climate change. It is ultimately science, going back to what's natural, ultimately science is against our nature, isn't it? We're not scientific animals, really. We're very much narrative-driven animals and who are persuaded by, you know, not necessarily data, but stories. In a way, you really go, when you attempt to communicate science, you're almost trying to get people to go against their very nature in what they accept and what they believe.
Now, I agree with that because, you know, so much of what they believe is interest, you know, is tied to who they are, mm-hmm. you know, to their sense of self.
Yeah.
And we are asking people to give that up.
Yeah.
And I admit, yeah, that's a big leap, you know.
Yeah.
And we just have to find a way to engage with them,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully we'll make progress.
Yeah.
That's all we can do.
Yeah, one would hope so. It does. I do feel sometimes that we're moving backwards rather than forwards for all of our best efforts. Like, you know, with the vaccine issue you raised, we've gone backwards. How can that happen? We had this, you know, and suddenly, you know, it's slipped and we've moved back. So I suppose we all put our effort in and keep moving forwards, but it is concerning.
Yes, it is.
Sometimes.
Who knows? Maybe Brexit might be a good thing.
Oh no! I don't think so. I'm not sure what we didn't even get onto the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics, but I'm not sure what world Brexit would be a good.
I don't know.
But it's certainly not a good thing for science. The UK's contribution to science is going to be quite badly damaged by coming out of the European Union. Even when you look at things like our involvement in the Galileo project, which, you know, we're not going to have access to this European SatNav project. And obviously, you know, when the press has mentioned that and put it to ministers, they've said, oh, it's okay, we'll just build our own. Well, we're talking billions of pounds for something that we've already paid for and created.
Yeah, I think that's the worst part of it, is that you've already invested into the project.
Yeah.
And if you leave, you no longer have access to it. So it's like, well, why did you put all that, you know?
I know, it's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. But then again, it's talking to people and getting them to drop. Because in Great Britain, there has been a culture for a while of blaming Europe for a lot of problems that maybe exist in our country that we don't take responsibility for ourselves. And also there are a lot of imagined problems as well. When you look at, again, not wanting to get too political, but when you look at the influence of immigration, a lot of people in the United Kingdom, and I suspect in the United States as well, see immigration as a problem and a drain on us economically, whereas really it's not. If you look at the figures, and you know, immigration's actually a really good thing for countries economically, but you can't persuade people with data and facts because they have these deeply rooted, deeply held prejudices. And it's hard to overcome. And I think a lot of the ideas about Europe and what Europe is responsible for have been held in Britain for a long time. And they've really come to the forefront. And I think the United Kingdom faces a very rocky 2019 because somewhere down the line, a hard choice has to be made. And I mean, my preference would be we don't exit the European Union, but somebody's got to make that choice. Somebody's got to determine, okay, that's not what we're going to do. And then obviously be held responsible to the people who wanted that to happen. And what do you tell those people? What do you say? You can't say, well, okay, well, we can't leave the European Union like you wanted, like you were persuaded and told was a fantastic idea because of the Galileo project, because they're not just not going to buy that. And I think this country I'd be very interested to see where we stand in 2020 because there's, you know, we very much have a deadline on making this decision and what are we going to do and what's our country going to be like in the next year, you know, next few years. And I think what we've done with Brexit as well, there's a lot of talk about democracy, but what we've done is actually quite cruel to future generations. We've taken away a lot of the opportunities. You know, my children, if we go through with leaving the European Union, my children won't have opportunities that I had as a youngster, opportunities that I might not have taken advantage of, but they won't even have that on the table. They won't have the opportunity to as easily go work in another country. And I just think that's so cruel and it runs against what our role is as a parent. Our role as a parent is to ensure that our children have more than we have. And what we've done in Great Britain, we've done the opposite. We've taken away from our children. I don't want to get on my soapbox too much, but I just think that the crows are going to come home to roost this year, and we'll have to see.
Yeah.
We'll have to see how the dice falls.
It does seem like a lot of things are coming in from every side, and we have no idea how it's going to turn out.
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at all the, you know, you look at all the distress in the United States as well, and, you know, politically, it's difficult to say what the political landscape's going to look like in the next 6 months, the next year. It's you know, things are just very unpredictable at the moment. It really makes me miss, you know, those years of politics where everything was a bit stable and boring. And then,
those were the good days.
Yeah, I'd just look at the obviously, you know, there was always something happening in politics, but it wasn't at the scale that it is now with just... It just seems like turmoil all the time. So
we'll see.
We'll
see what happens and hope for the best.
Well, yeah, that's what I've got literally everything crossed that things work out for the best. So, you know, whatever happens, somebody's not going to be happy, you know. So
that's
it's an
true
odd situation. Nobody, you know, there's going to be a large... With both the UK and the US, whatever happens with regards to Brexit, whatever happens with regards to, you know, the Mueller investigation, Trump's presidency, somebody's going to come out of this very unhappy, a large group of people. We just have to keep our head to the ground and our nose to the millstone and just get on the best we can, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, it's some people are going to be happy no matter what happens. Yeah. So, and it also seems as science communicators, we have a lot of work cut out for us.
We've got our work cut out for us, definitely.
You know, not just with physics and, you know, quantum mysticism, you know, we have anti-vaxxers, we have GMOs, well, anti-GMO people, climate change.
Yeah. Oh, don't, you're depressing me again, David.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Here we go again. certainly puts the idea of, you know, obviously the people would ask me what the harm in holding quantum mysticism and allowing that to continue is. And obviously it isn't ultimately going to cost lives, I don't think. But it does devalue physics, and I think that's a real shame. It also, you know, it devalues how wonderful actual nature is. And, you know, obviously more than wildlife, the very nature of our universe. I think it devalues that sometimes. And the elegance of that theory and, you know, when you look at the mathematics of it, it does devalue that to turn it into, you know, this... almost sorcery. I think that's a real shame, but I don't ultimately think it's going to cost anybody's lives. Perhaps when it's used, as it is used to, you know, it is used to justify things like alternative medicines and energy healing sometimes, which can potentially be dangerous.
That's what I was going to get into, you know, and disagree with you on. It's when it starts going into that realm of, energy healing, or you can imprint the quantum state of the healing molecule or something like that.
Yeah.
That is real. And, you know, in some countries, there's legislation, I think in Germany, for example, to allow homeopathic medicine, and I'm using that in quotes right now, into drugstores.
Yeah, so
people can go in there and buy water that they think is going to help them.
To be honest, in some areas of Great Britain, we have homeopathy on the National Health Service. So we've got a National Health Service that's struggling, that's very short of funds and financing, and we've still got homeopathy available on that, and we're still funding, or we were until very recently, still funding homeopathic hospitals. I mean, a lot of that has changed in the UK because of the work of a man called Michael Marshall and his organization, the Good Thinking Society. I don't know if you ever heard of the 1023 event, which is basically was a homeopathic overdose organized by the Merseyside Skeptics Society, which was quite a showy event when it happened, but it really helped launch this idea that homeopathic remedies are actually, you're just consuming water. And Michael Marshall and obviously the people connected to him and the Merseyside Skeptics Society have done a lot of really good work. And they've actually, it shows that when someone who wants to communicate science works very hard, they can actually turn the tide. Maybe that's definitely a positive note to end on, that if you look at the work of the Good Thinking Society, they've done a lot of good of making people reconsider homeopathy and getting it, you know, taken off the books with the NHS in the UK. So, you know, definitely, a credit to them and a credit to science communicators in general, really.
Yay. That's great.
Yeah, very positive. Obviously, there's still work to be done. But,
Of course, yeah.
They've done very well thus far, and it's taken, it's taken quite a few years, but we're seeing positive results, which is good.
Well, hopefully, it will continue. And before we start going back into even more depressing. maybe we can end there.
I think that's a fantastic place to end. We found a victory for science.
So
let's all stop now.
so before we leave, do you want to tell our listeners like where we can find you, about your blog and your science communication work?
So essentially my main source of writing, I write for a few different news organizations. My main blog is on Medium. So if you search Rob Lee Medium, which don't worry, I'm not some psychic shill who's going to tell you you can speak to your dead loved ones. But I do find it quite ironic that I've got Rob Lee Medium I'm directing people towards that. So if you search Medium for Rob Lee, you will find Medium's a large blogging site that a lot of journalists use at the moment because I'm, freelance. It's not always easy to find a gig. I also write for a news outlet called SciSo Media, which is a small news outlet in the UK. And that's it really. I suppose the easiest way to find me, if you search for Science First on Facebook and you see a little pencil as a rocket ship, that's my Facebook page. So if you add me there, I tend to put all the work and all the things I'm doing on there for all different news organizations and different websites, because I'm quite scattered. I'm not really focused in one place anymore. I tend to crop up here, there, and everywhere. So what I've found, the more I don't know if you find this, David, the more I've done science communication, the less it's become about myself as a person or a personality, and more it's become about what I'm trying to communicate. So, and that what that does is it makes it quite hard to follow a person as an individual when you tend to be popping up here, there, and everywhere, and doing different things. So,
well, I'll
did that make sense? Your... I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's makes sense.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning here. Well, actually, no, it's 6 now. So,
wow. Well, I'll be sure to put your links in the show notes, and hopefully, everyone will find you and read some of your stuff.
That'd be nice. And obviously, you know, if you'd like to leave a nice comment, do so. If you'd like to leave a negative comment, you can do that as well. that's your prerogative. I'll leave that decision to you.
Well, hopefully everyone will leave nice comments and learn something.
Well, we can hope, but I think we've made it very clear. Let's not expect miracles.
Okay, well, let's end there and not get back into the depressing stuff.
Thank you, David, for having me on. It's been a pleasure. Great show.
It was great having you as well.
Enjoying it very much, listening to it. So thank you for all the work that you do as well, and for giving science communicators a chance to talk to their audience, which I think is, and to talk to each other, which I think is very important.
Yes, that is all important. And thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us. As you can tell, Rob and I talked about a lot of things. And if you'd like to continue this conversation, feel free to leave a comment below. And if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share on social media. And be sure to check Rob out on medium.com and on Science First in Facebook and on Twitter. You can also find Science Bloggers on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I look forward to you joining us for our next episode.